You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks. She had a pet snake. She bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do. So she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
This episode was made possible by the support of our patron, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek.
You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast. I'm Chris, and with me is...
Oren.
And our special returning guest host.
It's Jonathan again.
I can never decide if to say returning special guest or special recurring guest. I feel like we should standardize that.
It could be a returning recurring special guest. Why not both?
Yes. To add more titles. Mm-hmm. That's a really strong story element you can have, and it fulfills your wish of having a lot of titles at the same time.
I cleaned the chalkboard once in middle school, so you should add that chalkboard cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, excellent. Strong work.
Let's add Father of Dragons and Breaker of Chains, too.
I am into it.
So today, Chris, what are we talking about today?
We are talking about wish fulfillment in stories, which is a fairly important topic that really does have a big significant impact, not only on author motivation for writing stories, but also how popular a story is.
Are we talking about genies here? Wish fulfillment?
Yes, absolutely. This is an entire episode about Aladdin.
Awesome.
Maybe we should do an episode about Aladdin. but no. So when we're talking about wish fulfillment, we're actually talking about wishes of the audience and the way that fiction can make them feel like their wishes are coming true. So it's not... A lot of times it does actually translate to the characters getting lots and lots of things that the character wants. But... It's actually for the purposes of pleasing the audience, and sometimes the writer, especially in situations where the writer is really writing for themselves and not for another audience, like in some fan fiction, for example, it can mm-hmm. be more like the author is fulfilling their own sort of wishes by writing. And I mean, I think the best way is to just talk about what it looks like. You know, like how do we know that a story has wish fulfillment in it?
Yeah, that's what I was not 100% clear on that.
Yeah. So, and there are a number of different signs. A big one is that the main character has lots of candy. And when we say candy at Mythgreens, we're talking about glorification. Like, mm-hmm. A big thing is having cool colored eyes. That's probably one of the biggest. The eyes are not just normal eye color. If the eyes are like violet or they change color or they glow in the dark... people like the idea of having really cool eyes, and so a lot of wish fulfillment characters have cool eye colors, possibly also cool hair colors, right?
Yeah, I can't read a book now where they comment on the character's eyes and not just kind of groan a little bit now. Like, it's not that it's individually bad, it's just so common, and now that I'm looking for it, it's like, oh, okay, I guess this character has weird eyes, they must be a protagonist.
As someone with cool colored eyes, I appreciate representation in my books with good eye colors. Like,
that's fair.
It just mm-hmm. makes me feel more related to them.
I use eye colors for love interests. Right? But, like, I don't usually bother that much. Because the assumption with a love interest is that you've got, like, this sort of, you know, staring into their eyes thing happening, and that you'll actually notice their eye color. But yeah, colored hair. If the character just doesn't, like, have serious challenges, or more like doesn't struggle to solve problems. You know, it's like, hey, I'm so powerful. No problem. Bad guys have got nothing on me. I totally took care of it.
Yeah, everything's fine.
Mm-hmm. and then otherwise, just getting lots of cool stuff. And the reason why, this may all sound vague, but the reason why it sounds vague is that wish fulfillment is very audience dependent. It's very demographic dependent and other dependent on the person, right? Because we all have different wishes. Mm-hmm. So those are like some general trends, but... it looks like different things depending on the demographic it's for.
Right, although, like, there are also some elements of wish fulfillment that have a huge reach. Like, And one of the ones that's very common over and over again is the idea that even though we seem like, you know, pretty common, normal people, we're actually special somehow. And that's, like, a big part of the lore of Harry Potter, right, is the idea of this normal kid. I mean, and granted, in Harry Potter, he's also, like, abused by his family. But in the idea of being just, like, some normal person who isn't particularly interesting or doesn't have anything super cool going on, but, like, actually, I'm secretly a wizard or an X-Man or something, right? Mm-hmm. Like, something will be revealed that will show that this character is super cool and the one or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, a huge draw across, like, a big audience.
Yeah. Right? I think that has two reasons why that's so popular. Number one, absolutely for wish fulfillment. That ordinary girl who the hot guy likes, or that farm boy who turns out to be like the heir to the throne, or, yeah, you know,
farm boys are about 80% chosen ones by volume, it turns out.
Or, you know, Joe Schmo, who, like, you know, like the hot chick likes and then gets to do exciting adventures, you know. I think those are all popular for a number of reasons. Number one is those characters, again, they are relatable and there is wish fulfillment involved with, like, I'm just an ordinary person, but, like, I could be the chosen one. But I think it's also just the other thing that makes it popular is that people like underdogs. And so having a character that seems to start off as an underdog, like, just makes it easier to get attached to them.
Mm-hmm.
No one likes seeing someone succeed who, like, worked hard to gain valuable skills and technology and then just applies those in a logical manner. That's just sort of boring.
Well, okay. So I know where that thought comes from, but so I've found that what it people do like that. It's just that is hard to pull off, right? Like, a lot of very well loved characters are specifically what you're talking about there, Jim. They're people who actually, like, worked for what they have. It's just that is harder to do and also pitch the character as an underdog. So very often storytellers will go with the whole, like, you know, you're special because of a prophecy, because it's easier to do that and then have the character also start off, like, in a disadvantaged position, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if the character actually, like, worked their way up into a position where they have, like, substantial skills, etc., then you have to come up with another reason why they're not doing so well. You know, like, they got themselves into trouble and now they're kind of outcast, for instance, or something else like that. And that's just harder to think of than having them start out at the bottom and then declaring that they're special.
I feel like the Luke Skywalker and Han Solo are actually a really good dynamic of, like, or a good example of the two ends of that dynamic. Because on the one hand, you have Luke Skywalker, who is special because of who his dad is, and that he was just happens to be really strong in the Force, right? And certainly doesn't seem like that was anything that he personally earned, versus Han Solo, who is, at least in theory, good at stuff because he, like, worked hard at it, right? And people like both of those characters for different reasons.
That makes sense.
Okay, but going back to this, like, specific group thing, because this is kind of really important. The thing about this is mm-hmm. that anybody who is not part of that group, if you fulfill wishes of that group, often is turned off and will not like the story. And there's no better example than Wesley Crusher. Wesley Crusher is the ultimate example of this. So I don't know about... I know this is true for Oren, too. And Jim, you'll have to tell me. But when I was a kid and I watched Next Generation, I liked Wesley Crusher.
What?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, because Wesley Crusher is a, like, a child wish fulfillment character. He's there to be like, oh, mm-hmm. if I'm young and if I was on Next Generation ship and imagine that I was, like, a genius and I showed up all of the adults, you know, like, you identified with him, you wanted to be him on the ship. It was wish fulfillment, you know. It's like you can insert yourself aboard the Enterprise, right? And that's exactly what he was written for. Strangely enough, that was his purpose.
And I mean, he also hit me at exactly the time when I was starting to get really frustrated that adults didn't take me seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like I was old enough to have serious thoughts. Obviously, most of them were wrong, but I was old enough to have them, but also, like, young enough that most adults kind of wrote me off. And so I was like, that I was at that exceptionally frustrated moment, and then here comes Wesley Crusher, who the adults write him off, and then he saves the day literally every time. And I was like, this is amazing. This is everything I want. This is the greatest character who has ever lived.
I dodged a bullet on that because I didn't watch enough TNG when I was young. I saw it in my 20s all the way through. So Wesley Crusher was just like really annoying and improbable and, you know, frustrating to see him be smarter than adults who trained their whole lives to do the science stuff. He's like, nah, I'm 14, but I did it. Never mind. You're stupid. And that's just like really feels punishing to these otherwise really competent and well-loved characters to see like their expertise and life's work just dismissively backhanded away by some. And it hurts more. It's frustrating more because I know he's a character written and fictional and not real. Like an actual child prodigy of that age, I'd like be less frustrated with because I knew it wasn't contrived. It's like the contrivedness of his competency that frustrates me. I wasn't the demographic like you're talking about. Like, I wasn't 14 when I saw it, so it felt insulting and frustrating instead of empowering to me.
Mm-hmm. I really want to know how 14-year-old Jim would have felt about Harry Crusher now. Harry Crusher? Wesley Crusher. This is like... Okay, so here's something that I'm curious about. I feel like there is a distinction between... And I'm not exactly sure where to draw it, but what I would call, like, legitimate frustration with a wish fulfillment character and what is more or less just, you know, some kind of bigotry or discrimination dressed up as annoyance. Like, for example, we were talking about Wesley, and I don't think it's wrong to say that Wesley hurts the next generation for anyone except his super target demographic, right?
Yeah.
But then you also have something like My Little Pony, which is clearly a wish fulfillment for young girls and gets a huge amount of, like, derisive hatred from, you know, people who are not young girls, mostly older guys, although there is also a demographic of guys who like it, but, you know, not focusing on them. You know, people talk about it in very derisive terms, and I think that is more to do with sexism than with, like, an actual flaw in the storytelling of My Little Pony, and I'm not really sure where to draw that line, like, and how to arrive at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's good to keep in mind with all wish fulfillment that there is definitely a double standard when it comes to which groups we cater to and how much privilege those groups have. That because, you know, men have dominated so many fields, the stories that clearly have wish fulfillment for men have gotten lots of critical acclaim. And then similar stories for any other group that is not white men have not, right? Mm-hmm. And I think one of my favorite example of this is The Name of the Wind. Okay, so this book has just gotten an incredible amount of praise and critical acclaim. And I started reading it, and the main character of Name of the Wind, like, he has red hair, but not, like, natural red hair. He has, like, red, like, scarlet, bright red hair. I'm not kidding. and he is the most just puffed up, arrogant character that could possibly be there. And I've seen arguments online about this character, and the defenders are like, oh, but it's a legitimate character flaw. But, like, arrogance is not a likable character flaw. Right? And it's clear that this character is supposed to be all that. It's supposed to be super badass.
Speak for yourself. I find arrogance extremely relatable.
That's good to know about you, Jim.
I definitely feel like the idea that his arrogance is a character flaw is added afterwards. Mm-hmm. Like, when someone is like, actually, I don't like this character because they're so arrogant, the person who didn't really give it any thought before is like, oh, but I did like this character, you're wrong because his arrogance is a deep storytelling device.
Sometimes arrogance can be used to, like, actually be a storytelling device and get characters into trouble they wouldn't have been in otherwise and can challenge them, and I appreciate arrogance as something to be overcome. I to be clear, I don't like it when it's used to excuse shitty behavior and then just label it as like, oh, that's his one flaw is he's arrogant, but it never punishes him in any way or right. them. Because mm-hmm. not only men are arrogant, I guess.
Well, I did not finish the book because I did not like it well enough. But at the same time, like, it is this character telling his own story. Mm-hmm. And it's clear that I feel like any time that you have a real character flaw, part of that character, you know, arc should involve trying to get past it, right? And it's clear by the way that he retells the story, that he is still just as arrogant as he ever was. And again, I don't have a survey data on this, but from the discussion I've seen so far, there does seem to be some gender patterns behind how well this character is liked. Mm-hmm. Like, women really do not like this guy. And it seems like he's a very definitely male, a wish fulfillment character. Again, the kind of critical acclaim Name of the Wind has gotten, I don't think any book with a similar female character that is meant for wish fulfillment would ever get that much acclaim. It's kind of similar to, like, Wheel of Time versus Twilight. I've compared them before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
They're both, like, flawed works, but not, like, terrible works. And they're both really popular. But Twilight clearly has, you know, wish fulfillment for women in it. And it does not have any awards. It is derided just across the board. Whereas, certainly, I mean, people like us criticize Wheel of Time. But the series has a Hugo.
Yeah.
Does it?
And so...
It's so weird. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it does. so, I mean, what I would say is that I don't think that wish fulfillment is inherently bad. I think when you have too much of it, it does start to make the story feel immature. Mm-hmm. Frankly, that's what that's the label people usually give to works that are very wish fulfillment-y. But at the same time, it's still, like, it makes your work popular, and if you know your target demographic, it's not necessarily a bad thing to do. At the same time, whenever we think about it, we just need to keep in mind that, you know, there is a double standard, and they are not graded on the same level, you know, when we're commenting on wish fulfillment stories.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, like, by the same token, if you are doing wish fulfillment for a white male character that traditionally goes unchallenged, it is something to think about because... You know, the universe willing, we are getting less racist, and it's, you know, in a generation or so, your story may not be looked on as kindly as it is now. Mm-hmm. If that's the goal you're going for. I actually have what I think is a really clear example of wish fulfillment that is fine while making the people who it is for enjoy the story more versus wish fulfillment that is toxic.
Okay, let's hear it.
And it is in Stranger Things. Mm-hmm. So mild spoiler for season two. So the first season of Wish Fulfillment is these kids playing D&D and their D&D game actually being important to solve the problem. Like, as a role player, that really spoke to me. I was like, that is so cool. I really wish that all of the hours I spend role playing could be useful in solving a serious problem. Right.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I'm living that dream, so I don't know about wish.
Yeah, there you go. So it was like I was really into that, but you know, and that's fine. Certainly, it doesn't seem like anyone was particularly bothered by it. Then you fast forward to season two, and they have a different kind of wish fulfillment with the same group, which is a girl gamer wants to join their group. She doesn't play role playing games, but she plays like, you know, arcade games and stuff, mm-hmm. and does like. All the things that they like, and this is also super wish fulfillment, right? This is wish fulfillment for nerd dudes who want to imagine this, like, perfect woman who is amazing at all of the things that they value, that they can, you know, objectify, and that, like, she will want to join their group, and then, like, you know, it gets toxic from there. Right? Because they spend a lot of time being like, oh, well, you know, it's, I don't know, man, can we let a girl into the group? And, like, that puts her in this weird situation of, like, having to prove herself. And, like, why would you want to be in a group with people you had to prove yourself, you know? It's like, that's weird. So I just think that that is a good example of how wish fulfillment can start off fine, and then if you're not careful, it crosses the line into something that will hurt your story.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the biggest problems with depiction of woman characters in many stories is like, okay, so there's nothing inherently wrong with a woman who is sexy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing really wrong with that. The problem is that so many women are sexy because the woman characters are there to play a role in a man's, like, fantasy, right? Like, she's not there for the woman audience members. She's there for a guy. And mm-hmm. it kind of distorts the way that women are depicted on screen, and it's makes demands of women that they live for men because all of the representation of women in media are there for men, and just all sorts of other things that do not work out well. And I think a really good example of this, I think, is Seven of Nine from Voyager.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, again, and if you compare her to specifically to Jadzia Dax in DS9, Jadzia Dax is a character who is sexual and indulgent and hedonistic, but she's clearly doing it for her own satisfaction. Is clearly not really there as part of a male fantasy. Is she is empowered character. And Seven of Nine is a character that is extremely sexy, but does not intend to be sexy. And she is supposed to be innocent. And so, like, the entire idea of her, you know, talking about sex and being in this super tight cat suit is just very voyeuristic because she is not intended to be that way. It is not empowering to her. And the suit is designed by a male character on top of all of that.
Yeah, they let that slip in some random episode. I forget which one, but
that was the most mind-blowing throwaway line from Voyager. It was like, yeah, I made that suit for her. And it's like, you did what? Why?
it's like, what was the point of even dropping that? We all just assumed that she made it herself, writers. Why did you have to dig that hole and then jump into it?
Mm-hmm. that said, though, there are lots of works that have wish fulfillment for women. The problem is that they are all labeled as being only for women instead of for a general audience. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, romantic comedies, for instance, you know, mm-hmm. or Twilight, or, you know. But like, you'll see things in, I think probably one of the big ones that does have more general audience is like The Hunger Games. Mm-hmm. And the whole, like, there is two men who is courting her that Katniss has to choose from. Like, that is a very, like, woman wish fulfillment thing that is present in a Hunger Games, which is probably more intended for women, but is clearly very successful among a general audience.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, that is, it's definitely, it's, the market is getting more accepting than it used to be, but there's still, like, a double standard, mm-hmm. I think is sort of the takeaway from all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Outside of the question of sexism, it's also possible to get so involved in your wish fulfillment that you can forget to build a plot, and that can be a problem. I want to use the two examples of My Little Pony and then the animated series Lego Secrets of Elvendale.
What?
The Lego branding. Yeah, okay. So Jim, it's a cartoon show about elves who are magic elves who live in a magic elf world, and it's technically a Lego show, and the Lego branding is, like, super hidden. It's like they look like, you know, they're normally drawn characters, but, like, you see, like, a Lego brick under the table. And like, or like a Lego brick pattern in one of the trees.
It's so bizarre. It's actually, I can only guess that there's actual product. There's all actual like physical toy that's like a Lego elf thing.
Right. Google will tell me if there is.
Yeah, it's kind of ominous, but that's not actually what I'm here to talk about. Is the weird Lego branding? No, it's that. So My Little Pony starts off with showing us this really amazing magic world full of ponies with cutie marks and like cool fashion design and all of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it also starts with Twilight Sparkle finding this prophecy about the Nightmare Moon. And so it's like, you know, we get to explore this world, which is clearly wish fulfillment, while it builds a plot at the same time, versus Elvendale has a very similar opening sequence where they like just go and explore the elf world for a while, but there's no plot. It's just like, hey, let's go to the guy who raises dragons. Cool, we're gonna do that. It's like, let's go check out the cool treehouse. It's like, we'll do that. Sounds fun. And if you're really into that, you know, that elf wish fulfillment, then okay, that's fine. But if you're not, you're just like, okay, when is the story going to start?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you want an example of how you can have your wish fulfillment cake and your eat your plot too, that metaphor got away from me. But you know what I mean.
yeah.
Just like, you know, watch those two openings side by side and you'll like see how it's done.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely stories that if they are entertaining enough and if they've set tension ahead of time, they can take a, you know, some time to dwell on the wish fulfillment. I think Harry Potter is definitely a wish fulfillment story for kids. One of the reasons why it's so popular. And it does something similar where we have an opening that focuses on sort of what happened with Voldemort. And then we have this sort of very tense opening with the Dursleys. And we talk more about the issues. But then we have a, you know, trip right after a whole bunch of things have gone down and he's finally been kind of temporarily liberated from his abusive family. We have a trip into Diagon Alley, you know, where we spend some time just exploring how fun it is to be in the wizard world.
And to be rich.
And to be rich, yeah. Yes, he finds out that he has
rich
a whole,
in the wizard world.
Whole vault of gold. And then he gets an owl. He gets a pet owl. You know, like all these other things. You know?
Yeah. Although, and I think it's worth noting that Harry Potter, in terms of it, how of its popularity versus its wish fulfillment, I think in some ways it's actually fairly restrained. Like when I'm rereading it now, the part that really sticks out as being like a grown worthy wish fulfillment is how good Harry is at Quidditch.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. To the point where, like, literally the only way Harry can lose Quidditch matches is for the match to be canceled or for him to get, like, attacked by a monster while he's playing.
Yeah.
Or whatever, right? Like, he's so good at Quidditch that the skill of the other players is, like, not even considered a factor.
Yeah.
But
it is... It is worth noting, though, that it is the only thing that he's... At the beginning of the story, it's the only thing that he's good at.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, shows the restraint that Rowling had... Rowling, you know, despite making a wish fulfillment story, she really was good at balancing candy and spinach. And Quidditch is clearly over the top. But, you know, otherwise, he's still, you know, that's his one area that he really shines. Until later, mm-hmm. he gets good at other things, but...
He gets real good at that Expecto Patronum. It's very important.
Right, he makes just... unicorns or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Expecto Patronum is just, like, everywhere by the end. Everybody's doing it. It's all the popular kids.
It's almost as good as a gun.
Well, against a... I mean, it's arguably... It's at least better than a gun against Dementors, right? There's at least, like, an implication that, like, Dementors can't be hurt by physical damage. Mm-hmm. It's, like, specifically what it's for.
Yeah.
But arguments about Harry Potter spells aside.
Yeah. But yeah, I think wish fulfillment, like... You know, it is something that you can consider and actually actively think about when you are formulating a story. I think it's particularly falls in what I would call the attachment category, you know, which is talking about, like, how are we building audience attachment to the main character and making them feel emotionally invested in certain things happening in the story. But you do have to choose your target audience. You do have to choose which reader group you are targeting, which... You know, it's generally good for marketing and making things that are popular anyway, but for wish fulfillment, that's absolutely essential.
One type of wish fulfillment that I have also, again, I've found to have a fairly wide appeal, but is also, like, very easy to get wrong, is various kinds of cool animals.
Mm.
Like, people of all ages seem to really like animal sidekicks.
Yeah.
Right? Like... In, you know, the animals of Avatar, The Last Airbender, and even to a certain extent in Legend of Korra, and they weren't nearly as good there, but they're still very popular. You know, people like cool animals who are friends with the main character. It's just like, it's like a thing they really seem to enjoy. But it's really easy for the animal sidekick to accidentally become too powerful and then just, like, suddenly be the main character. Like, that happens in the Lyriel. That novel where she's got, like, the magic dog that at first just seems like regular wish fulfillment, and then, like, as you go through the story, you realize this dog can literally do everything.
Yeah. And definitely when I've seen that, part of the issue has been that the writer thinks it's funny. You know?
Yeah.
To have an animal in the story that seems like it's not important, but is actually, like, pulling the strings behind the scenes, or is, like, an actual god in disguise, or, like, thinks it's funny that, like, you know, it was the butterfly, you know, like that kind of, no one suspects the butterfly. But I think the thing that it's easy to lose track of is that when you're doing that, it's funny for you and you're making fun at expense of your own story, which is not good, right?
Not generally a great move.
Not generally a great move. It's like, you know. Choosing an item that is subversive just because of its subversiveness. It's like, well, unless you're writing an entire story, that's purpose. But yeah, no, like in Philip Pullman's Dark Materials, the daemons. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everyone wants a daemon. Literally everybody wants
one. They are
one,
super
okay?
good wish fulfillment because not only like when you're a kid, they shapeshift. Like, you have not only do you have a magical companion that you're, like, psychically linked to, you have, they shapeshift, so they can turn into different animals. And then when you get into adult, they choose a shape, but that shape is like an inner reflection of like who you are or something. And people love that. I think that's why the Harry Potter houses are so popular, is they love the personality-based houses.
Yeah, man. If my personality can't be represented by some weird mix of magical animals, then what am I even doing?
Seriously. I must be a badger because sometimes I don't care.
Yes, absolutely. All right, so we are actually out of time for this episode. Thank you, Jim, for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
If you at home, if anything we said piqued your interest, you can email us at podcast@mythicrants.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week.
If this episode resonated with you, post a review on iTunes to increase the range of our spells. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean, and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast, opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Coulton.